Empire Lines uncovers the unexpected, often two-way flows of empires through art. Interdisciplinary thinkers use individual artworks as artifacts of imperial exchange, revealing the how and why of the monolith empire. In this episode, Dr. Dorothy Armstrong untangles British efforts to redefine colonial Indian culture through a 19th century knotted pile carpet woven in Lahore Central Jail.
In the V&A's Cloth Workers Centre lies a large and dramatic knotted pile carpet. A design of stylized blossoms and leaves covers its entire central space, organized into a trellis of interlocking octagons. Untied woolen loops twist around the vertical warp threads, creating a soft velvet pile that tempts us to touch it. This carpet was produced in an Indian prison around 1880. It's one of a pair purchased by the V&A in 1881, but one of them is lost. These carpets, one present and one absent, tell a story of the ruthless efficiency of British cultural imperialism in the colonial period. Their production, design, and materials challenge conventional ideas around the authentic or traditional in so-called Oriental carpets. Perhaps the biggest challenge to our conventional expectations is in the carpet's making. It was not the product of local Indian craftspeople with an enduring tradition of artisanship. Instead, it was made by Indian prisoners under coercion in the central jail of Lahore, the home of the British government for the state of Punjab in northwest India. Unraveling the choices made in the production of this carpet, who made them and why, reveals the systematic processes behind Britain's colonial bids to redefine Indian culture. In 1858, the British government took responsibility for the East India Company's possessions in India. For the next 90 years, India was ruled directly from Westminster until independence and partition in 1947. During the colonial period, the British ran an extensive jail system. Indian prisoners, both male and female, were incarcerated for defying British expectations of behaviour. Foucault describes efforts like this as the colonialist bid to remodel inmates as appropriate colonial citizens. The British administration set out to capitalize on India's vast economic potential. As prison numbers grew, jail workshops and labor gangs were set up to defray the costs of prison upkeep. Jail carpets like this one were woven in India from about 1860 and became a commercial success. The Central Jail of Lahore was a major centre of carpet production. Charles Latimer, a British commissioner in Punjab, reports that the modern equivalent of £4,000 worth of carpets were sold from Lahore Jail in 1905. The amount was even larger a decade or so before, at the time when this carpet was made. Designs, materials, and specifications for carpets were provided by the British jail overseers, whilst Indian weavers in British jails were subject to absolute coercion. The Indian prisoners wove what the imperial power desired, and the British then sold them as authentic Indian carpets. British government officials tried to define and codify their new possession to understand India's vast and varied populations, resources, languages, cultures, arts and manufactures, and their economic value. First published in 1881, the Imperial Gazetteer of India, for instance, ran for multiple editions until 1931. It defined India for British readers, and those British expectations were then imposed on the local population. As part of this work of codification, the British colonial government in Punjab organized surveys and exhibitions of Punjabi crafts, manufactures, and raw materials. The 1881 Punjab exhibition was a major highlight. This particular carpet was woven for it. Government reports on earlier Punjab exhibitions were tentative and exploratory, but by the time of the 1881 exhibition, the British in Punjab had a high level of confidence in their ability to judge indigenous crafts and manufactures. The exhibition was organized as a series of competitions in different media, with the great majority of judges being British dignitaries and officials. British government memos were sent out ahead of the exhibition, clarifying expectations for submissions. There was a significant buzz around these carpet submissions. The British arts establishment believed that Indian carpet making was facing a crisis in the late 19th century, and that India risked losing its rich carpet heritage by adopting European designs and colours. These European and North American commentators strongly opposed change in Oriental carpet making. They sought to fix these examples of the material culture of the East in the past, denying them the possibility of modernization. The British arts establishment wished to revive what they perceived as the carpet weaving tradition of India. This set the scene for a colonial rescue package, which rather than reviving something traditionally Indian, introduced yet another form of colonial tastemaking. Henry Baden-Powell, a senior British government official in Punjab, sent out instructions for carpet entrance to the 1881 exhibition. He explained, "We do not wish to see Indian workmen forsaking the beautiful patterns of Oriental carpets. No prize will be given to any carpet not purely Oriental or original in design or not copied from a good Oriental original." He suggested that these Oriental originals should come from urban Persia and Afghanistan, specifically Herat and Kabul. Baden-Powell was sketching out a British-defined idea of what a so-called Oriental carpet should look like and setting Indians to work on it. That idea was not the Mughal style, with its bold and naturalistic floral motifs, sometimes showing the plant's roots, nor was it the hard-wearing, flat-woven Dari, both produced for centuries in India. Rather, it was the intricate, structured and stylized floral styles derived from Persian workshops. This Persian sensibility appealed more to the British than Indian carpet traditions. The British authorities in India took Baden-Powell at his word. They based one of their entries, the particular carpet now in the V&A, on a Persian carpet sold by the Maison du Louvre, a 19th century Parisian department store. It had been imported from Persia to meet a specifically European taste. Walter Benjamin described Paris as the capital city of the 19th century in matters of culture. Thus, the British idea of an authentically Indian carpet was further mediated by the global tastemakers of Paris. The V&A gel carpet offers challenges to conventional expectations of Indian carpets beyond its production and the sources of its design. India has a distinguished history of dyes produced from plants and insects, but this carpet raises questions about this practice. It shows reds, whites, yellows and blues on a black background, framed by borders on a scarlet background. Some of the dyes have, however, faded to grey. This suggests that they may be dyes produced in Western laboratories, which became readily available after 1838 when W.H. Perkins synthesized aniline purple. By the late 19th century, German dyes were used globally. Both wool and the fine goat hair known as pashmina were often used for carpets in Punjab. But again, our expectations are subverted. The wool for this carpet may have come from local flocks, but it could equally have been merino from Australia, a growing import encouraged by British imperial free trade rules. In the early 1880s, Caspar Purdon Clarke, an arts advisor, was shopping for crafts in India. He had been sent by the powerful and richly endowed British Government Department of Science and Art. The department directly controlled the South Kensington Museum, now the V&A, and Purdon Clark would later become the museum's director. The department influenced many international exhibitions held in 19th century Britain. It also established new art colleges across the UK and took control of existing ones, setting the syllabus and examinations, providing books and appointing head teachers. This centralised infrastructure and network of design control is now known as the South Kensington System. The purpose of Purdon Clark's shopping trip was to fill perceived gaps in the India collection of the South Kensington Museum. Originally formed from exhibits in the 1851 Great Exhibition, the museum's collection was intended to provide models of excellence for British designers, architects, and manufacturers, and thereby improve the international commercial success of British goods. India was seen as a crucial source of such inspiration in the 1880s, but only when mediated by judicious British officials and their collectors, museums, exhibitions, art schools, and publications. The department gave Purdon Clark a budget of around £500,000 in today's money. At the 1881 Punjab exhibition, he bought this gel carpet and a second gel carpet, now lost. One of our two carpets took first prize, but we don't know which. The remaining V&A carpet cost over £2,000 in today's money, a significant sum. Both carpets certainly met the South Kensington Museum's standards for an exemplary Indian carpet. Both carpets were initially displayed at the museum. One was then loaned out to manufacturers and art colleges across the UK as an exemplary model of traditional and authentic Indian carpet making. It never returned to the museum. We pick up the lost carpet's trail in the archives of Templeton's Carpet Manufacturing Company in Glasgow. A gel carpet loaned to it by the South Kensington Museum in the late 1880s was copied by its designers. Those designers had been trained at the Department of Science and Art's own Glasgow School of Art. Templeton's had developed the chenille process for the mechanised weaving of patterned pile carpets. Following knot plans meticulously hand-painted by their department-trained designers, Templeton's reproduced the lost carpet for sale in the UK and for export to Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa and the Americas. These two carpets participated in a complex process of transcultural exchange. Made by Indian prisoners in Lahore Central Jail under British government guidelines, which privileged Persia, possibly using Australian merino wool and German synthetic dyes, they were purchased with British government funds for the South Kensington Museum in London as exemplary Indian carpets. But the journey didn't end there. At least one of them was sent to Britain's industrial cities as a model of excellent Indian design and reproduced and exported by a Glasgow industrial manufacturer to European settler populations worldwide. From their parlours and lounges, they learned ideas of what an Indian carpet should look like. Aesthetic values were defined in South Kensington by the museum and the department. Cultural appropriation and control were seamless under this so-called South Kensington system, and across India, its momentum was almost irresistible. British men with strong links to South Kensington were appointed as curators and principals of Indian museums and art colleges. In Lahore, for example, John Lockwood Kipling, father of Rudyard, was founding director of both the Lahore Museum and its Mayo School of Art. Indian museums displayed what the British viewed as exemplary crafts, and their art schools trained Indian artisans in the styles and skills to produce them. More Indian artisans developed their skills in British regimental and mission schools. Colonial district officers collected objects for displays like the 1881 Punjab exhibition, transmitting British expectations to remote areas. The Journal of Indian Crafts, commissions, purchases, and prizes like the one won by one of our carpets reinforced British expectations. Indian voices were largely silent in this process. Some British voices resisted this powerful system of cultural and aesthetic control. Sir George Birdwood was an acknowledged expert in the field who had observed almost 50 years of the South Kensington system in action. In 1909, he said that the British should leave Indian crafts strictly alone. There was also some moral opposition to the trade in carpets made in jails. In 1894, the United States banned the sale of imported prison goods, which opened up space for an indigenous export industry to develop in places like Amritsar, 30 miles from Lahore. Craft production certainly continued outside the South Kensington system, but the British had taken control of the mainstream. Jail workshops were the most extreme expression of this British control. Weavers there were coerced into producing exactly what the British thought Indian crafts should be. This brings us back to this particular carpet in the V&A and its weavers. To our contemporary eyes, it might seem muddy in design and palette. It doesn't have the drama or vivid colour of some geometric Anatolian or Caucasian carpets, nor the graceful intricacy and subtlety of colour range of some Persian and Mughal carpets. Instead, this carpet represents one particular British ideal of what an Oriental carpet should look like at the end of the 19th century. It was deliberately created to meet the colonizers' taste in a powerful example of centralized colonial government intervention in the crafts of the colonized. Weaving was largely the work of men in jails. Some women wove carpets, and one wonders what happened to their children whilst they spent years weaving the British dream of Oriental carpets. Weavers' voices remain difficult to uncover. C.H. Brierley, a British prison official, reported in the early 20th century that Indian prisoners preferred to break rocks and build roads than to weave. They often requested transfers. British data suggested that prisoners did not take up weaving as their trade after their release. We can only guess at the wearisome monotony and dehumanising discipline that caused this rejection of weaving by prisoners. Textiles embody the troubled relationship between coloniser and colonised, as Gandhi recognised when he adopted spinning and weaving as the symbol for taking back control in India. This carpet reveals a dark parallel between two kinds of coercion. Who defined what was aesthetically ideal and how acceptable behaviour was enforced in the colonial prison system?
Empire Lines is produced by Yelena Sofroniewicz. For more episodes, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.